Today is October 15th. Welcome to Shitpost. I'm your host, Jared Holt. And before we get started today, a few housekeeping notes. Some of you who follow along on Twitter will see I got a new job recently. I just joined DFR Lab as a visiting research fellow. So I appreciate the congratulations. And for the podcast, that doesn't mean a whole lot of change. One thing that might change, though, is I am considering bringing a newsletter on for paid subscribers. If that sounds like something that could be interesting, please let me know. I want to kind of gauge audience reaction and see how much interest there might be in something like that first. So please reach out, Twitter, DM, whatever, there's a million ways to get in touch with me. Just let me know what you think of that idea and what you might want to see in it. Last little bit, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast listening platform and leave a nice review if you're so inclined. It helps us a lot here. Tim Pool Clips, who is going to remain anonymous for the sake of this interview, they are the world's leading wool beanie watchdog. So, Tim Pool Clips, TPC, what should I call you? Anyway, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jared, and thank you for having me on, and of course, congratulations on your new gig. Tim Pool Clips works for me, or at Tim Pool Clips is just fine.
All right. So today, as listeners probably guessed from the title of this episode, we are going to talk about Timothy Daniel Pool. March 9th, 1986, the world was shocked to discover the first human baby delivered with a wool beanie sewn onto its head. Tim Pool is 34 years old. He is a huge YouTube content creator, and it seems like until recently, there's been some people kind of raising red flags around Tim Pool, levying criticism, poking fun at him. But as Tim Pool continues to rise in digital spaces, and as I, personally see an increase in his rhetoric going more apocalyptic, more far-right conspiracy angle, I think it's about time to kind of sit down and figure out, who this guy is and, what's going on here. There's been a huge blind spot among disinformation and misinformation. The tech beat reporters, I feel like, have just totally ignored Tim Pool for whatever reason may be. So I'm happy to have you on the show today to help me understand that, but more importantly, help the audience understand that. So let's start with Tim Pool. First rose to national fame during the Occupy Wall Street protest in New York City in 2011. He was praised across media for being among the best live stream footage people on the ground. In 2011, Fast Company profiled Tim Pool and the media company that he belonged to at the time, which was called The Other 99, and wrote that Pool in The Other 99, quote, has been cleaning the mainstream media's clock in its coverage, doing more with $500 Samsung Galaxy S2 phones on Sprint's 4G network than TV networks can muster with thousands of dollars of gear, satellite trucks, pretty anchors, and helicopters. Young, handsome, and gregarious, Pool is the face of the newly sprouted media operation. So, Tim Pool Clips, let me start with this. I guess, when did you first become aware of Tim Pool? Are you familiar with his history, you know, dating back to 2011 and this, you know, Occupy Wall Street coverage?
Yeah, so I first became aware of him in around 2016, 2017, in the wake of the 2016 election and Trump's inauguration. And at that point, I was actually a fan of his. I was pretty disillusioned with politics. I'd been following UK politics quite closely, but I hadn't really delved very far into US politics at that stage. And I found this guy. He seemed pretty reasonable. He seemed sort of centre-left, which is what I was at the time. And he sounded like he really knew what he was talking about. And I sort of liked what he was saying. I liked what I heard because it sounded like exactly what I was thinking. But slowly, as I kept watching him, I began to realise that he was not as neutral or not as moderate as he was trying to claim. I noticed his coverage favoured the right, kept continually favouring the right, and that he constantly attacked the left. And I have since then, late 2017, middle 2017, I stopped following him as a fan. I briefly stopped following him at all, really. But I've always been aware of him since then, and every now and then I would have checked back on one of his videos. But more recently, I've become much more alarmed because I was thinking of starting a website, which I started with this account as well, which is grifter.news. And I was initially planning on covering a whole range of grifters. And then suddenly I realized I wouldn't have the time for that. So I thought, okay, let me go and have a look. Who are the grifters who are making the most money or getting the most views and having the most impact? And I realized it wasn't actually people like Dave Rubin. It wasn't people like Jordan Peterson or Ben Shapiro, at least directly. I mean, if maybe combined with all the clips from their lectures and debates that are on the internet, maybe they would be up there. But they weren't actually the ones who were leading the pack. It was Tim Pool, and he was leading by a massive amount. He, over the last few months, he's been getting 100 million to 100 million, to 110 million views. And he has been, which is double what I think the closest competitors, I think, were PragerU and Stephen Crowder or something, which is double what they get in monthly views. And at the same time, as you say, very few people are actually following him or are even aware of him in that regard in the media sphere. But if you go out and you look on Twitter, he's got hundreds, thousands of adoring fans who will, not only on Twitter, but on YouTube, on Facebook, the moment you criticize him, they will suddenly come out the woodwork and they will tell you how you're evil, how you're offending him, how he's the only sane leftist, how he's the voice of reason. And as you said, not a lot of people cover him. And I think that is partially because of the whole narrative. He's very good at crafting narratives. And one of the narratives he's crafted is one about himself. And that is that he is, it's as if he's like recording from his mom's basement in his beanie and in his denim shirt and jeans, which he's been wearing since the first footage of him that I could find online from around 2003 when he was skateboarding. He hasn't changed at all. And with this account, with the Tim Pool Clips account, I've also now recently been speaking to some of the people who knew him during Occupy, who knew him during other parts of his career. And one of them suggested that basically it is in some ways a costume. It is as if he's playing a character. And I think that is true. I think the character he's playing is just an everyday bloke who will talk to you about the news and give you his opinions. He calls himself now he calls himself a journalist in some situations, but he also calls himself, whenever he's criticised, he retreats and says, "Oh no, I'm just a man angrily shouting at the news." And so I had been vaguely aware of his Occupy roots, but it was, again, only recently with this account that I really dug into it. And over the past few days, as I was preparing for this, for coming on this show, I've been staying up until 3 a.m. every night, going through and finding everything that I could find about him. Some of it I already had found previously in the last few months, but some of it was brand new. And as you mentioned, he was featured in all sorts of news outlets. He was sort of NBC, Al Jazeera, There was New York Times, there was Fast Company, there was Times. He appeared in the Times Magazine Person of the Year 2011 and 2012, as he was written about in those issues as the voice of Occupy Wall Street. But also, interestingly, he has appeared in several, or at the time, he appeared in several journalism textbooks. He appeared in several other less strictly academic books. He appeared in several journal articles, including some journal articles about philosophy. So he was really completely like a cultural phenomenon. And he had like philosophers analyzing his content. He had sociologists like taking him apart. It was he was really this massive figure who had a real cultural importance. And I think, as you mentioned, he was the most successful Occupy Wall Street streamer, but he wasn't actually the only one. And that actually led to quite a few tensions with the other live streamers I spoke to at the time from that time. But I think something that I've also found quite interesting is thinking about this whole idea of him playing a character. He was actually in around early 2011, he actually moved to LA for a few months and tried his hand at acting in Hollywood. Unfortunately, his career didn't work out, unfortunately for us.
I'm now picturing Tim Pool still in his like costume with the, you know, denim shirt and the beanie, like in an episode of like CSI Miami or something, like just the same character rambling about the news, but in a completely different setting.
Well, my theory is that he went to LA and he was bitten by a radioactive director, which gave him the superpowers of being like a movie character but without a movie. And so that's why like the evidence at all points that way. He always wears the same costumes. He has catchphrases like "It's complicated" and "I don't know, man." But also, you know, his life story contains all these different arcs. So after LA, he moved to Newport News in Virginia. And then after that, in September, he was helping his brother build a skate park. And one day he turned on, he was on social media, and he found a clip of a cop beating up a protester and saying something like, "My nightstick is going to get a lot of action tonight." And that motivated him to turn to Occupy, to travel to New York and to start streaming. And that was his sort of big break after having previously worked in some street canvassing roles as in environmental and in the anti-war movement. And interestingly, someone who knew him during that time said even then he was very good at getting people to like him and good at convincing people of things.
Right. So, you know, any conversation, you know, as we go forward and talk about kind of the arc of Tim Pool, whether it is the man or the character he's seemingly portraying, there was a time, you know, 2011 to 2014, 15, I would, you know, feel pretty comfortable saying, where Tim Pool was effectively kind of the face of this cultural phenomena, this live stream, you know, sort of unfiltered live stream type of coverage. He was looked to, admired, respected by journalists. And to this day, you know, I want to bring that up because to this day, when he's seeking to garner some credibility for himself, he will point back to his history doing reporting. And additionally, in 2013, joining Vice Media, producing and hosting content there and developing new ways of storytelling. He went to Ukraine, live streamed mass protests. In 2014, the next year, he joined Fusion TV as Director of Media Innovation and Senior Correspondent. And, you know, for a time had seemingly a very promising career in news media, being looked to and admired by others in the field for kind of innovating the way that things are covered. And knowing that history of Tim Pool, it kind of makes it even more fascinating to see his development into kind of where we are today. And people can just go to the Tim Pool Clips account. I'll link it in the description of this episode to see what I mean. You know, talking about Civil War, one of the clips I think I saw you post recently was him complaining that leftists were going to rewrite the dictionary or something. You know, just stuff that I would expect maybe from like Glenn Beck or Alex Jones is now coming out of the mouth of Tim Pool. You know, and I guess it all started in 2016 when Tim Pool went solo. You know, it's, and from there it just happened. You know, one of my working theories has been that Tim Pool has kind of designed, like his brain has warped in along with social media algorithms. Like he has a SEO basically running in his brain to get the clicks and to get the viewership. But I'm kind of curious, especially as somebody who started watching Tim Pool as a fan, you know, within a year or two of him going independent, you know, kind of your, I guess, broader thoughts on that arc, you know, from being this respected, you know, seemingly respected figure in the journalism world to being kind of, and maybe this is going to be a little harsh, but the what I hear, he sounds just like a right-wing crank.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think a lot of the seeds have been there for quite a while. It's just nobody was really paying attention, I think, in his whole branding and narrative exercise. He's been able to, for a very long time, get away with quite a lot of things. So he was, as you mentioned, he was very well respected in mainstream media. Interestingly, he wasn't very respected by the protesters at Occupy by the end of it, and particularly he wasn't respected by the other live streamers. They felt that he was creating a sort of parasocial relationship with his audience, and if other live streamers criticized him, even in 2011, 2012, they would get brigaded on Twitter, they'd get brigaded in their live streams, and they would be attacked. And a lot of that was also about, partially, I mean, 2011, he was speaking, in 2012, he was speaking to the BBC on at conferences at South by Southwest. He was speaking at all these big events, and he was even giving classes at journalism colleges. And but at the same time, the protesters and the people at Occupy felt that he was making it very much about himself. He was building a brand about himself rather than about the movement. And he also had the tendency to film things that other activists weren't so keen on. For example, there's a case where he would film people who were puncturing cop car tires, and when that, and other sort of more less legal things, which ended up with people being put in prison. And he, or potentially, I don't have firm evidence on that, but I would imagine, particularly because he even then in 2011-12 stated that he knew the police were watching his live streams, and he said they'd be stupid not to. And so that whole problem of him thinking that he's doing this brand new, this transparent thing, actually ended up harming the sort of very movement that birthed him. And then going, as you say, 2014, 2015, he was still producing some good work for in Ferguson. He produced a really, really excellent, he was the reporter and the narrator for a really, really good documentary all about structural and systemic racism in the city. And I think perhaps that might have been because he was given a script, or that he had director, another crew working with him. But I'll genuinely say it is one of the most eye-opening and one of the best documentaries I've actually seen on YouTube. But I think as he continued doing that, he again more and more realized he was always drawn to the spectacle. That's something that the people I've spoken to say, that he was, other people at Occupy would live stream 3-hour, 4-hour General Assembly conferences. But Tim Pool, he was drawn to the action. He was running around. He was whenever there was something exciting happening, he would be there. But he wouldn't be there for all the more mundane stuff. And that spectacle, again, even in the Ferguson documentary, which I think is so good, I think it's called a Report from Occupied Territory or something. There were some protesters smashing up a cop car after the verdict against after the officers who killed Michael Brown weren't they weren't charged. Then he was filming the car, and then and he was saying, "Oh no, this is, look at this car." And then a protester walked up to him and said, "Compared, something along the lines of, compared to all the lives that have been lost due to racism, this is just a small price," or something like that. So rather than telling the whole story, Tim Pool only showed half of, always only showed half of the story, because you can't easily capture something like systemic racism and issues like that on a at a protest. You can, with a documentary or something, it's much more easy when you're looking at the issues. But by just focusing on a protest, as they say, the sort of like a riot is the voice of the unheard. Well, in Tim Pool's riot coverage, the voice he's often communicating with the voice of those who are heard too much. And again, that whole process of him making about what he saw and his brand came to a head in about, as you say, 2016-17, when he left the companies he was working for at the time, at Fusion. And he said, I'm trying to find the exact quote that he was saying. He was talking all about building a brand, and he said, "Trust is the number one most important factor in delivering news. As the big news orgs lose reach and it disperses down to individuals, people are looking for a selection of humans, not brands, to listen to." And I think he really understood that. And he has said to me that he doesn't chase the algorithm. And I'm not so much interested in whether that's true or not, because I'm more interested in actually seeing that regardless of whether he's actively chasing it, he is obviously very, very attuned to it. And he is able to really know what will go viral, what will be successful, what will get people interested, and how he can profit from that attention. And
right. To his credit, yeah, like Tim kind of understood what... I don't want to seem like I'm comparing Tim Pool to Alex Jones directly. Those are two different animals. But like Tim Pool kind of understood the same thing that InfoWars understood, something that the political right, at least in the US, was more attuned to, it seemed, than the political left was, which was sort of the shift in attitudes towards news sources and the way that people's relationship to the news and to their sources of information was changing. And Tim, to his credit, just like you were saying, I think that he saw that, recognized that, and capitalized on it very early. I don't know that what he's saying, people looking for individuals to get the news from rather than, a cable news channel or something, is entirely wrong. I mean, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. That's definitely how things have gone. I mean, there was a book from 2017 by, I think her name was Rachel Bosman or something. It was called something like who Can You Trust? And her whole, at least part of her thesis, was that people have the trust within society has moved from a sort of horizontal perspective, from a vertical perspective, where you trust the church, where you trust the media organization, where you trust the government, into a much more horizontal alignment of trust. And I think, again, that book is from 2017. It's just right around the time when Tim Pool was also having these organizations. Sorry, Rachel Botsman, I think is her name. And I think getting news from individuals isn't necessarily a bad thing. And there's been lots of good by being brought out by people who are able to move faster than some of these big institutions. At the same time, in 2014, Tim was on a panel with some reporters from the New York Times, and they pointed out to him that although it's very admirable, it's very impressive what he's doing with his live stream, he does, even though he tries to, he doesn't do any editing, but he's still not giving a full perspective. He's only giving a live stream from one perspective, and something like the New York Times, they will send out to a protest, or I guess then they would send out to a protest maybe 3, 4, 5 journalists, and then all of those would be joined together by the editors, the perspectives and the different views and opinions and things that they witnessed. So I think it does, even though that whole move, that the move towards looking for individuals for news is not necessarily a bad thing, it also comes with a lot of hurdles that need to be overcome to make it really successful and to fully replace what has come in the past and what used to be there, the structures that used to be there.
So Tim went independent in 2016, 2017. He, was presenting as center left. That has kind of eroded, I believe I saw recently he made a video explaining that he was voting for Trump. So I feel like, that horse has left the stable as far as, presenting as a center left voice. It's like Dave Rubin. I don't think he really tries to claim that anymore. Dave Rubin doesn't claim to be a liberal. He's a classical liberal. He's an old school liberal, or whatever that means to him, But I think sort of most people see it for what it is. And I think increasingly with Tim Pool, people are kind of seeing his content for what it is, in no short part because of, the clips that you've been putting out. So I want to know, before I start kind of, I'm going to take a quick tangent real quick. I just have to know, how much Tim Pool content do you watch on like any given day? Are you watching all of it? Because he puts out a lot of content.
Yeah, he puts out normally around a 25-minute main channel video, and he tends to put out five, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more, but generally it's very consistently five videos on his second channel. And then, which range between 10 minutes and 25 minutes as well. And then he puts out a 2 to 2.5 hour live stream every night. And as much as I would like to say I get to watch all of it, I just don't have the time. I don't have the energy, and I don't have the will. And I think I would go completely insane. And people ask me sometimes, how do you stay sane? And my answer is partially, that you're operating under the assumption that I am still sane.
Right. I think I've said something to that effect to some reporters through the years.
Yeah, exactly. So to answer the question directly, it varies. Some days I will watch every single video he puts out. Some days I'll go days without watching a single video. And some of the ways, I've got a few different tricks up my sleeve to make things a little bit easier for myself, and to very easily cross-reference what he said between multiple videos and between multiple videos and multiple channels. So I just wanted to touch, though, on something else very briefly. You were just talking about Trump and how he said he's supporting Trump. Well, it's actually further than that. He's not only said he's supporting Trump in several videos. He's actually said that he's going to be, and he thinks other people should vote Republican across the board. And he's even donated $2,800 to a Republican candidate. So he still claims that this is because the left has lost their mind and voting for Joe Biden would be voting for the suicide of America and all that. But he, at least in his political endorsements and his political contributions now, is very much made an almost complete turn towards the right, despite claiming that he's actually still a disillusioned liberal, which is in his Twitter bio, which is funnily enough similar to, I think, what Dave Rubin had. He said he had something like the last liberal in his Twitter bio for several years before he also finally admitted that he's right wing.
Right. So going back to Tim Pool's career arc, so I think we're up to about 2016, 2017 here. He's gone independent. He's, has these channels. He's uploading this content. It's news content. In your research and digging around, Tim Pool was already kind of a cultural phenomenon. I'm sure his, whatever name recognition and niche circles certainly helped him get his start. But you kind of alluded to his appearance on the Joe Rogan podcast, giving him a big boost. What are some like big breaks that Tim Pool had? Like what put him on the map and sort of solidified his status and growth into now what is just an absolute, like, you know, I feel comfortable saying like right wing YouTube channel. It's almost like a miniature empire he has now between his channels, this Subverse thing. I think he's involved in the like Facebook alternative Minds. I don't know whatever happened to that, but I think he was sort of, if not directly involved, at least like very friendly with them. How did he continue to balloon once going independent?
Yeah, just before I again, just to touch on what you were saying about the media, like a media empire. I mean, that is very much where he's built up. I mean, he now he recently bought a house, a massive house with I believe 8 bedrooms and in several external buildings outside, or structures, I should say, and a basement basketball court, which he's now converting into a basement skate park. And he has several people living with him, his producer, his co-host, his former co-host for his podcast, and I'm sure there are several other people as well. It's almost, some people have likened it to that he's building a cult compound. I'm not sure I would necessarily go so far just for, let's say, legal reasons, but I certainly think the people who say that are not very far wrong. But to go back to the question of where he got his breaks, well, obviously, as we've discussed, he got his big break during Occupy, and I think the single biggest moment, there was a couple of breakout moments when he was, one day he walked into Michael Moore, who was meant to be having an interview with CNBC, but for some reason they didn't arrive, so Tim Pool live streamed it. But then the real big moment was during the, I think it was on the 15th of November 2011, Zuccotti Park, which had been occupied, was evicted. Tim was the only live streamer. The other live streamers who were part of Occupy, they didn't have their batteries charged. Journalists were barred from going there. So he was the only person on the ground who was filming, who was streaming. And he streamed for 21 hours that day. And then the following days, he also streamed. And he got several hundred of thousands of viewers on that live stream. I think that was the big moment where people started paying really real attention to him. Then I think the next moment he went along, he coasted on that for a while. The next one was obviously being hired by Fusion to be the director of media innovation or something along those lines. I think that gave him a lot of credibility, which is a little bit ironic because in 2012-ish he was saying that that journalists are the enemy, that journalists are evil, and that he would rather work for 1 million people giving $1 each than one company giving $1 million, and then he ended up working for Fusion, which I think is owned by Disney and is owned by several big, or was owned by several big companies. And so that, I think that gave him some more legitimacy. So then afterwards, the next big break, I would say, unless I'm forgetting something along the way, would be in 2017 in February, on the 19th, Trump referred to at a rally. He said that something had happened the night before in Sweden, and then suggested that refugees were to blame. The day after that, Paul Joseph Watson, formerly from InfoWars, he tweeted, "Any journalist claiming Sweden is safe, I will pay for travel costs and accommodation for you to stay in crime-ridden migrant suburbs in Malmo," which is the Swedish city. Tim took him up on that offer. So Paul Joseph Watson paid him $2,000, and then Tim raised another, I think, $18,000 from his fans. And he went to interview the mayor there, and he interviewed several different people. Now, overall, the narrative that he came out of Sweden with was that it was largely safe, and that it was safer than Chicago, that it was safer than a lot of American cities. But along the line, he still managed to do quite a few interesting things. The first of which was to claim that at one point the police had to escort him out from a situation, which the police and local media disputed, saying that that wasn't true, and that the police car and Tim happened to just be going the same direction, but that they weren't escorting him. It wasn't anything like that. And the other thing is that in his videos in Sweden, he spoke to the deputy mayor, who is, I think, sort of a center left, maybe even a bit further than that, political leaning. And Tim was quite friendly to him, but then afterwards he's like, well, you know, I don't know how much we can. He's liberal, so we have to take that into account. And then he had already before the trip been fear-mongering. He'd been saying he'd been warned not to go. Other journalists had said it was dangerous. And so when he was in Sweden, some of the people he talked to were... he talked to a couple of residents and a migrant. But then he also spoke to someone called Chang Frick, who had founded a website in Sweden, which was... and Tim just said, oh, he's a controversial figure, he's aligned with the right. Well, actually, he's aligned with the far-right party in Sweden. I think they had actually helped him set up the website. Then another person he spoke to was another Swedish right-wing figure who said, you know, to Tim that the police have lost control. And then other publications, he said that radical gender ideology is damaging academic freedom. Then Tim, in another video in Sweden, he spoke to a businessman who claimed to be so scared of backlash, he asked Tim not to show his face or to use his real voice. And then finally, Tim also spoke to three guys who later emerged were allegedly part of a fringe conspiracy organization in Sweden, and that elements of that organization are also skeptical of things like the Holocaust. Now, Tim didn't provide that context at the time, or at least I don't think he did a good enough job at providing that context of who those people were. And he didn't really push really hard questions to people or really question some of the meta-narratives that he was crafting. And now what a lot of people don't know is that he wasn't actually the only journalist who was in who went to Sweden. Another journalist, James Patrick, he went to Sweden at the same time. And I think this is quite relevant to the rest of Tim's career. There are always, in anything that Tim's doing, almost always, there are other people who've been there who are better sources of information, but who receive little or no recognition because Patrick, he gave a much more nuanced picture. He wrote a 7-article series all about his trip to Sweden. He spoke to the mayor, but then instead of speaking to figures from the right and the far right in Sweden, he spoke to academics who studied crime statistics. He spoke to the local police captain. He interviewed dozens of local residents, and he provided a much richer and a much more nuanced account of the whole situation. And again, going back to what the people I spoke to about Tim at Occupy, Tim, again, in Sweden, he went for the spectacle. He went for the, even if he didn't necessarily agree with it at the end, but he went for the, this is a no-go zone. These are the crime rate has risen because of migrants, and people are afraid to speak their minds because free speech is under attack. Now, again, overall, Tim did say that things weren't as bad as had been made out, but that doesn't take away all the content in his videos, which is actually what his audience is going to take in. They're probably going to forget 3 months to, you know, a year down the line that Tim said, oh, things are different. And what they're going to remember is that the guy said, I'm too scared to show my face because I'm worried about backlash, or these figures said, you know, the migrants have come and they're bringing crime into Sweden. And it just shows that this other guy was able to, and he is definitely someone who I'd consider on the center left, that there are people out there who can do exactly the same thing that Tim can do, but they can do it better and they can provide a better picture of the situation. And I think even now that is the case. Well, now especially that's the case. And so that brings us to that's the Sweden. So then just going through his breaks. The final big break, I would say, was so in 2019, he moved to making, he'd always make a video on his main channel, but now on his second channel, he went up from making about 3 or 4 videos to making 5 videos every day and making them and releasing them at very reliable times in the day. And then on February 8th, he appeared on the Joe Rogan Experience. And following that interview, there was a minor bump in his in YouTube search interest for him. But there was a much more substantial one when he went back on the show on March 5th, 2019, to speak to Jack Dorsey, the Twitter CEO, and Vijaya Gadhi, who's Twitter's head of legal and policy. And he quizzed them. He asked a whole lot of questions, which other sources have gone through and sort of debunked some of Tim's narratives that he was pushing there. Even Joe Rogan was sometimes being quite critical of the way Tim was asking questions. But Tim's YouTube search interest for him skyrocketed after that.
Right, because finally, it was their guy, sticking the finger in Jack Dorsey's face about this supposed, massive tech censorship that they, have claimed for years is happening.
Exactly. And then he was then invited again onto the Joe Rogan Experience, and I think that really cemented his growth. If you look at the graph of YouTube search interest, I've made one. I don't think I've made it public yet. But if you look at it, you can just see those dates. You can see the spikes in search interest, and then you can see just the continual growth after that. Before that, for even 2016, 17, 18, he was doing okay. He was getting there was some interest for him. But it just completely, after going to 5 videos per day on his second channel, after being on Joe Rogan and, as you say, quizzing Jack Dorsey and being the guy that all the right wing narratives, putting out all those right wing narratives that had been building up about conservative censorship, he was that figurehead of that movement. I think that's where he also gained his very right wing, his much more right wing audience. Although even going back to looking at videos from 2015 or 14, he was making very different content. He was making content about big corporations being problematic, about privacy violations, about corruption. But he would still actually get pushback from right-wing people saying, "Oh, Tim, this is wrong. This is you're crazy. You're a leftist." And I wonder if he took that on board and realized that maybe if he made videos like that, he wouldn't get so many views, which is why then. From about 2018, particularly I think when AOC came on the scene, he's made about 167 videos just about AOC over the last 2 years.
Wow! Because people click on it,
that cemented his growth. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. He puts her in the thumbnail. He puts Ilhan Omar in the thumbnail, and suddenly people are clicking, and suddenly people are interested in what he has to say.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't you say earlier that you had spoken to Tim and that Tim had claimed that he does not, design his content around the algorithm? Is that correct?
Yeah, he said to me, I mean, this was quite early on. So I should give a bit of background. I started the account, I think, around the 25th of June at the Tim Pool Clips account. And 3 days later, Tim Pool was already following me. And since then we've argued back and forth. About once a month he'll come into my DMs and say that I'm the world's worst grifter or the worst grifter because of how I'm grifting off of him and how he thinks I'm secretly right wing and actually I'm trying to harm the left's case because my content about him is so bad. And and we have these arguments. And then at one point I asked him right near the start, I said, "So is it accurate that you're chasing the algorithm?" And he basically said that no, he's not. He just he's just been lucky. Basically, was the sentiment that he was giving. Which again, I think, regardless of whether he thinks that's true,
I think we should be skeptical of that.
Yeah, I would
because the thing is, Tim, to my knowledge, is still monetized on YouTube. He has Patreon and various crowdfunding accounts. So for him, increased viewership, which is really the only metric you have online, is clicks and eyeballs. It is in his best financial and career interest to do what he must, to say what he must, to keep those eyeballs there. And it's hard for me to imagine that somebody with, what at one time, I would have maybe considered a pretty profound or pretty clear, understanding of some of the flaws and the way that different media works. It's hard for me to think really that he has maybe no awareness or that he truly believes that he's just happened to strike it luckily. It does seem. That was kind of the point of everything he was doing, right? I mean, I'm just That's my hot take. I don't have, you know, anything hard to back that up, of course, but that's just how it kind of comes across to me.
Well, I've got a little bit more to back that up, and that's that, again, going back to those videos from 2014-15, those titles, they were in some ways, I mean, they weren't quite as inflammatory as they are now, but they were in some ways more, but they were, again, I would say, almost in a lot of ways biased, not necessarily even to the left, but to a more libertarian anti-establishment view. And so then the titles, he's sort of become more and more outrageous. But at the same time, he has, in his videos, he's got a browser extension that censors all the trigger words in articles, like swear words, but even words, I think, like sex. He will hide when he's showing them on screen, just so he doesn't get dinged by YouTube. And he will, if he's got a news website up and there's a picture, a controversial picture or something, maybe someone, a protester with blood on their face, he will often he will blur that part of the screen out. So he's obviously very aware of what can get him taken off, and he'll say things like, oh, this could get me banned. And he will phrase things instead of, I'm trying to think of an example.
A person told me one time that Tim will not say Hitler on air.
Yeah.
He'll allude to him as like an awful historical figure.
Well, you know, interesting. Kind of. Yes, he'll say something like a failed artist who was in World War II. But at one point, he accidentally said a famous World War II hero. And once he realized he had done that, and the video went up, and I think some people clipped it, so, you know, him calling Hitler by accident, calling him a World War II hero, he went and he quietly edited out that portion of the video where he said that. He won't say these things. He'll create different ways of saying something. And instead of murder, he'll be like, someone who made someone dead. Like, I mean, it's not quite that crude, but it's at that level. So he knows that. And I reached out to him again just recently saying, how many of your videos are demonetized, or how many of your videos are monetized? And he said about 90%. And I'm now hearing from other YouTube creators that that's not, that they're saying they're more near about 70%. So he's obviously very aware of what can get him censored. And both has, you know, said to me privately in the DM that with about the monetization, but also publicly, he knows that if he says or does certain things, it will harm him. So I think on the flip side, it's quite clear that he knows that some things will be more successful. And I don't think he can pretend that he doesn't know how the algorithm works. In 2019, he wrote for Human Events, the conservative news website. He said, he wrote about, and this is again criticizing the left, but I think it's as relevant for him. He said, get people mad, get paid, but how do you keep milking the same cow over and over? You need to radicalize, and the content needs to stay fresh. After all, stale news doesn't sell. Is Trump racist? Gets a million views, but you can't write the same story twice. Tomorrow you write, Trump is racist, then Trump is the most racist, then is Trump like Hitler, then Trump is like Hitler, then Trump is worse than Hitler. It's earning points, visible social approval points that make us feel good. Social media is a fucking drug that is polluting our minds. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on here, but
oh, you can swear here.
So the
name of the show is Shitpost.
That is true. So yeah, those titles, if you, instead of being Trump is racist or whatever, you know, like AOC is radical, AOC is a communist, like those sort of things, he knows that you need to keep escalating your rhetoric and escalating your titles in videos, well, in newspapers, but then I think he also would apply that to videos. And again, that's another interesting thing, speaking to people at Occupy, or who had been at Occupy, they said that they think with Tim, it's not necessarily about the money, although I think it definitely plays a part, but they said it's more about the attention and the validation that he gets, and that is something that he really craves. And I think throughout his career, whether he does it consciously or not, he knows what works and he knows how to succeed on YouTube.
So, you know, we are sort of coming up on time here. So I just want to zoom out a little bit and go back to something that you said at the start of our conversation, which is that you started the Tim Pool Clips account because what you saw coming from Tim Pool was beginning to concern you more seriously.
Yes.
Can you speak more to that effect? You've been doing great work. And like I said, I think Tim Pool's content has been this massive blind spot for whatever reason. Maybe it's his presentation. Maybe tech reporters just aren't as well versed in YouTube as we want to admit. Maybe the sort of caricature of him in the beanie or whatever is like, it feels silly. It could be 100 different things, right? But the fact is he has not really, I feel like, been discussed by the serious people in the room, if you will, whoever you may feel that is. But, you know, what kind of things were you hearing this very, you know, especially this year? His rhetoric has really gone in a much, I think, aggressive direction, would be fair to say. Can you talk a little bit about what was concerning you to the point that you made this account and were trying to, you know, are now trying to get people to pay attention to Tim Pool? And in your Twitter bio, you even say, you know, if you're writing something about this guy, please reach out. I want to help you, you know?
Yes. So I would definitely, if there are any tech reporters, there's anyone, even, it doesn't have to be a tech reporter, it could be a YouTuber, it could be a blogger, anyone who wants to make content about Tim Pool, I would also encourage them to get in touch, because I do have some resources that might be useful for you in your reporting. But some of the things that I've been noticing, some of the rhetoric, a big thing, I think partially might be biased because that's also when I really started focusing on it, on him again in this way with the account, was him, his content about the Black Lives Matter protests. And that sort of thing. I started off in sort of May and early June writing to my friends every time a video came out. I was like, oh, fuck Tim Pool. He's like lying. He's doing this, all sort of stuff. And at the end, I was like, I keep doing this, actually. And there's no one else who's doing it. Maybe, or I mean, there are some people who make videos about Tim Pool, but not in a focused manner. They do all sorts of other things. So I thought, well, I think I should really dedicate myself to this and try to look at this, because he has said over since the beginning of June, he has said in at least, or maybe I should say around, because then, he said in around 62 videos, he has said something along the lines of the left will come is coming to your house, the left will come to you, they're not going to stop coming. And specifically using those words, the left will come to your house, or the woke will come to your house, or Black Lives Matter, or Antifa, they will come to your house. And the rhetoric like that, in 62 different videos in a 2-3 month period, combined with his selling food buckets from the same source as InfoWars, as well as him encouraging people to buy guns, as well as him saying he himself has bought guns and ammunition and is doing gun training, as well as saying that people shouldn't come onto his property. He joked with Cassandra Fairbanks that, you know, if people, anytime anyone even entered his driveway, they would be on his property and he would be able to stand his ground. All of that sort of rhetoric and that fear that the left is going to come to your house, drag you out, call you racist, and put, as he says, insane definitions in your dictionary. You know, won't anyone think of the dictionary? You know, that Alex Jones would say
God, please save Merriam-Webster.
Exactly. You know, the Alex Jones would say they're turning the freaking frogs gay. Well, Tim Pool would say they're turning the freaking dictionaries gay. That sort of rhetoric that he's pushing, it puts his followers in a mindset that makes them very paranoid, very worried, very scared, a lot of anxiety, and potentially could lead to some real life consequences. And I'm sure it will, if it hasn't already. For example, with this plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Now, one of the people who was engaged in that plot had at one point watched Tim Pool. Now, I want to be very clear. I'm not saying that Tim had anything to do with it necessarily. But I'm saying that Tim Pool put out content. He called the governor an evil, evil woman. He said she was a fascist. She was an authoritarian. And again, maybe he wasn't involved in this plot. Maybe it's unfair to suggest that or to even think that. But at some point it will. At some point, one of his followers is going to say, Tim Pool called this person a fascist. He said it again and again. He said, we need to stand up for ourselves. We need to stand up as Americans. We need to stand up for our rights. We need to support our constitution. We need to support Trump. And they are going to do something. And the consequences are not going to be good. And whether that's being at a rally, whether that's being going to someone's house, like some of the Proud Boys have done to people, there is going to be something that's going to happen. And I am trying to, as much as I can with this account, trying to stop things like that, because I think it's really dangerous, and I would really hate to see something serious happen as a result of Tim's rhetoric.
Right. Like, that kind of rhetoric, I think, is concerning to a lot of people when it's coming out of the mouth of Alex Jones or Glenn Beck. A lot of the fears that you just expressed, that, you know, maybe somebody will hear this rhetoric and believe it and internalize it, and even if it is just a fraction of a percent of the viewership, you know, it's a matter of scale. You know, Tim Pool, as your research has shown, is pulling in more eyeballs, has a louder megaphone than even, you know, these right-wing talkers and sort of social media giants. He is a kind of, you know, force to be reckoned with online at this point in history. So, you know, I just wonder, like, where it goes from here. And sort of, like, in the recent days, mostly... Oh, this is a roundabout way of me saying, talk to me about the podcast. You started podcast. You said it's what, 2 hours every night?
Yeah, 2 hours every weeknight.
Oh, my God.
And he has, I mean, the thing is with the podcast, he's had two co-hosts, and one of the first was Adam Kriegel, and the second now is Ian Crossland. But he's also got his producer, I think Lydia Evans is her name. But that podcast, he's had Cassandra Fairbanks on several times, but he has several other right wing figures who's had on. He's had Brandon Straka from the Walk Away movement. He's had Kim Klasick, who's the African American woman running for Congress in Baltimore, who had that huge Twitter moment and has now haven't seen anything from her since. But of course, Tim, he saw that advert she put out and is now and had her on the show. Just the other day, he had on the chairman of the Proud Boys. And he gets these big figures on and then promotes them to a wide audience, all the while taking in thousands of dollars of live stream chats with the Proud Boys yesterday. I think it was at the half hour mark, not yesterday, I think the day before, the half hour mark, he had already raised, I think, $1,000 from live chat donations. And I'm trying to... Yeah, I've forgotten what your exact question was, I have to say. But I would just say about also going forwards with the narratives that he's pushing. I mean, a big one that he's been pushing is concerns about voter fraud, just like Trump has been doing. And I think that could get quite dicey if the US election is at all contested, because Tim Pool has been saying for months that he is that there is voter fraud going on. And I think he's been trying. I think it's quite interesting. After the Michigan kidnapping plot, he's really toned down his rhetoric. He suddenly claims that he doesn't talk about civil war anymore, even though that's something even his own fans and even himself has joked about previously. And again, he claims, "Oh, I've only talked about civil war in 25 videos." Well, actually, I went through and ran the numbers, and in his last 800 videos, he's talked about civil war in around 200 of those, and almost 200 of those videos, almost a quarter of his videos, he mentions the word civil war, or someone else on his podcast mentions the word civil war. And even his own podcast host, Ian Crossland, he said to Tim, just very recently, said, the sort of language you're using could encourage someone, if they think Antifa is bad, it could encourage them to go get a gun and do something. And Tim's response was sort of complete. He was like, "Oh, that's just normal communication," but it's not, because normal people don't get hundreds of millions of views each month, and they don't repeat the same 5-6 points over and over and over again like Tim Pool does. And again, to go back to what I said before, I think it is dangerous, and I think at some point, maybe not now, but maybe with the election coming up, there could be consequences if things are less clear than we would like after November 3rd.
I think that is a good point to wrap it up here. You know, people who are interested in keeping up with your work on Tim Pool can follow the Twitter account at Tim Pool Clips. There's a website in the bio there that you said you're working on, and I'll have links to all of this in the show description on whatever podcast player you're listening to this on. The final question that I have for you is the final question that every guest on the podcast gets. And I consider Shitpost kind of like a shitposter's like tastemaker. We've had lots of viral, ahead of the curve suggestions on here. Will Summer talked about Gators Daily. Mike Hayden talked about, I'm forgetting the name, but this account that mashes up animal videos with like synthwave and like lo-fi hip hop stuff that I'm just addicted to now. So let's hear it. What is your favorite thing on the internet right now?
You see, you've set me up there for a massive fall. Because I do have something, but it's a lot less exciting than what everyone else has, because over the past few months I've been almost 100% focused on, if I haven't been doing something in my work life, it's been to do with pool.
I've got a really fun one. So you can say yours, and then if I need to back you up, I'll come in with my fun one.
Okay, that's cool. I've discovered the Boys on Amazon Prime. For some reason, I'd given that a complete miss last year when the first series came out, but now I'm sort of addicted, and I think there actually are quite a lot of interesting issues discussed in that, which are relevant to the wider world. But as I said, that's nowhere as interesting as looking at actual exciting things on the internet. I mean, the one funny one was when someone the other day posted a picture of a gulag and said, like, this is what the left wants or something, and then it turns out it was actually a screenshot from the Muppet movie, and you could actually see Kermit being dragged into the gulag, and that was just an hilarious interaction to see.
Oh man, so good. My favorite thing on the internet, I gotta thank Chris from Ether Rich for tipping me off to this, is this is a very small Facebook page, Facebook group. It's Bikers and Friends of Bikers That Swear to Protect Barron Trump. I love this so much. It's so good. It has like, I think it's between 3,000 and 4,000 fans on it, but 3,000 to 4,000 is almost too many by itself. but that's just been cracking me up. It's just a plethora of beautiful posts about Trump's youngest son. So I think that is just going to about do it for us. Plug your stuff. I plugged you a little bit. Where can people keep up with the Tim Pool universe that you are exposing, and you know what's in the works in the future? Where do you see yourself taking this?
Yeah, so the account is at Tim Pool Clips on Twitter. The website is Grifter, but it's spelt out like a tech brand, GRFTR.news, Grifter.news. But you can also, I think, if you type in timpoolclips.com, I think it should forward you there. That's the main thing. The website is, I'm for more long form content. I aim to continue adding things on there. At the moment, I'm working on some getting a more comprehensive history of Tim Pool than is on Wikipedia or Rational Wiki or all those different places. I'm also working on going through some of the guests he has on his show to look at their histories. And going forwards, I hope to just produce more analysis of Tim and potentially eventually other grifters. But at the moment, it's very much on Tim, because I think he is so understudied and underrepresented in coverage of the right, or the online right.